Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we've got the co-author of a brand new book, a phenomenal book of great interest, Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. Our guest will be Paul Waldman, who co-authored this book with David Brock. We'll be talking with Paul Waldman for the full hour, so please enjoy the show. I think you're going to be interested in what he has to say. But first, before we go to Paul Waldman, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Media Giraffe Project was born out of a growing public concern that the media are losing their ability to equip citizens with the knowledge they need to demand accountability in government. Bill Densmore started Media Giraffe in 2005 to find and spotlight people using media in sustainable and innovative ways to foster participatory democracy and community.
The idea of Giraffe is people sticking their necks out, doing something outside the mainstream.
Densmore says that when he started the project, the declining numbers of mainstream news outlets and opportunities for journalists were very troubling. But now, even though the situation is even worse, people are beginning to see opportunities in the new media environment, particularly on the Internet.
It's clear that we have a demand-side problem in the media business. It isn't just a matter of shrinking mainstream media. It's also a matter of how do we give citizens the tools they need to become smarter consumers and creators of media.
The Media Giraffe Project will be sponsoring a conference called New Pamphleteers, New Reporters on June 4th and 5th in Minneapolis, just prior to the National Conference for Media Reform. The term pamphleteer refers to the writers and opinion makers of the colonial era.
In some ways, we're returning to that kind of media environment with lots and lots of voices of all kinds of stripes and colors, rather than a fairly small number of fairly mainstream voices that don't differ that much between them. So what we're doing in the University of Minnesota is we're creating a unique event that's designed to give local online news and community web entrepreneurs and activists a chance to share hands-on advice about best practices, hear research in the field, and get advice on advertising, legal, and organizational issues.
For more information on the Media Giraffe Project and the new pamphleteer conference, go to mediagiraffe.org. For more information on the National Conference for Media Reform, go to freepress.net/conference.
A House subcommittee held a hearing this week to consider legislation that would ensure all broadband networks will be open and free from discrimination. The Internet Freedom Preservation Act, House Bill 5353, would prevent Internet service providers from blocking, slowing, or degrading legal content over the Internet. Democrat Edward Markey of Massachusetts introduced the bill with Republican Chip Pickering of Mississippi in February. Markey opened the hearing by deflecting arguments against net neutrality. He said the debate is not about whether carriers can perform necessary network management or about fighting piracy, prioritizing emergency communications, or dealing with copyright issues. Net neutrality and his bill only applies to keeping lawful content accessible to the public and the Internet open to new innovation.
And so this whole idea that this legislation helps piracy is 100% wrong. It's a red herring. We should actually put an aquarium out here. There are so many red herrings that are floating around to mislead about what the intent of net neutrality is.
Pickering said the bill is balanced and consistent with Republican principles.
It clarifies network management or strengthens it, and it clarifies lawful to unlawful uses. And that this is a good ground upon which to start in this committee of getting the consensus to American values and ideals in a good way.
Walter McCormick, president of the U.S. Telecom Association, and the National Cable and Telecom Association's Kyle McSlaro weighed in against the bill. Both denied that there's a problem with broadband providers controlling content. Representative Anna Eshoo of California disagreed.
There are cases of degradation, and I think it always ends up being in the interest of growing and larger companies to be tempted to protect what they have and not let another foot in the door.
Free Press Policy Director Ben Scott warned the committee that media giants could not be trusted to operate in the public interest and keep the Internet open to everyone.
Internet policymaking is premised on a simple idea. We will remove regulations from network operators, but we'll draw a line to protect consumers in their access to an open Internet. A duopoly market of phone and cable companies will not discipline itself.
For more information, visit SaveTheInternet.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, coming to you this May 11th, 2008. Today, our guest is Paul Waldman, co-author with David Brock of the new book, Free Ride, John McCain and the Media, just published recently, quite up to date, in fact. And to give some sense of what the book is about, on the cover is a quote from Chris Matthews of MSNBC. The press loves McCain. We're his base. And then on the back, there's a quote from Joe Scarborough, also of MSNBC. I think every last one of them would move to Massachusetts and marry John McCain if they could, referring to the press corps. This is a book that I have had the privilege of reading over the past few days, and it's my privilege now to welcome Paul Waldman to Media Matters.
Hi.
Hey, Paul. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you very much. You know, one of the things that was striking to me about this book was the tone. This is not a book, if you're looking for the McCain bashing book, this is not the book to get.
Well, we didn't set out to give 101 reasons why people should vote against John McCain. That wasn't really our interest. What we were interested in exploring is the relationship that he has with the press. And, you know, this is ultimately a book more about the press than it is about him, because I think that the way that he has managed over the course of the last decade or so to get such extraordinary coverage, better than any other politician, Democrat or Republican, is really a lesson in some of the weaknesses of today's political media.
Yeah, it's what's also striking as I read the book and as I thought about it is there's really no one who disagrees with that argument offhand that I can think of, that McCain gets extraordinary press coverage from the Washington Press Corps way beyond any other politician in either party.
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing. For a long time, it's been conservatives who were suspicious of McCain who complained about how what good coverage the press gave him. Now that he's the presumptive Republican nominee, I think you're starting to see them begin to raise objections to that just because, he's their standard bearer. And I've been on a couple of radio shows debating this question with conservative journalists. And what you usually find is that they start off saying, well, no, that's really not true, that he really isn't getting a free ride. But then as they begin to talk about it, eventually they end up saying, well, yeah, he really does.
And so
I think that you're right, that there really isn't anybody who can offer any kind of persuasive refutation of that fundamental premise. But the more important questions are, why and what are the consequences?
Yeah, and before we go into that, which is the topic of this book, Paul Waldman, I mean, one thing I did notice recently is there's been a spate of commentary by journalists out of Washington saying, well, down the road, once the campaign starts, we're going to start getting tough with McCain. Basically saying, but we're not tough with him until then. Right now, we're going to give him a free ride.
Yeah, they seem to be always assuring us that at some point in the future, the coverage is going to become more critical, more investigative, and do the kinds of things from a journalistic standpoint that we would expect them to do with any presidential nominee. I think we've seen some faint glimmers of it here and there. There's been, an investigative article here or there that explored some aspect of McCain's coverage and his image that hasn't been explored in enough detail before. But by and large, we've still seen the bulk of the coverage. It just kind of repeats the same pattern. So they refer to him as a maverick and a straight talker, all those kind of the tropes about McCain that we've gotten so used to. There are some exceptions here or there. You know, there was a good article in the Arizona Republic the other day exploring the idea of whether McCain really is a maverick. The conclusion that they came to is he isn't. And it wasn't too surprising coming from the Arizona Republic, because the truth is that the Arizona media know McCain much better than the national media do. And their coverage of him over the years hasn't just repeated that he's the maverick straight talker. It's been much more critical. And as a consequence, his relationship with the Arizona media is extremely contentious, nothing like the mutual admiration society he has with the national press.
Our guest today, Paul Waldman, the co-author with David Brock of the brand new book, Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. We're going to be talking about this for the full hour today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Paul Waldman is the author, co-author of three books in politics and media, in addition to this, is a frequent commentator on media and politics in the United States. Our phone number here at WILL-AM 580 is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Paul Waldman, one of the things you and David Brock do in this book is fairly systematically go through the myths surrounding John McCain and then how that affects the way he's covered by the Washington Press Corps and presented to the American people. And if you would just start off by just maybe going through some of the more prominent myths, maverick, straight talker, reformer, man of integrity.
Yeah, those are things that I think will be familiar to anyone who has paid attention to the way that McCain has been covered over the years. We've heard that so many times, literally thousands of times. I mean, when was the last time you picked up an article about John McCain that didn't call him a maverick or a straight talker? This is the image that has been built up, that he is somebody who goes against his party more often than other politicians. In fact, that's not true. The idea that he is an ideological moderate, that's not true either. In fact, he's a pretty staunch conservative. That he's the straight talker, the one person who doesn't engage in spin, that's not true either. The idea that he is kind of the avatar of reform in the Congress. There are, in fact, other people who have much stronger records on reform. The idea that he alone among politicians doesn't do things because they're politically expedient, that he's always operating on principle. These are the kinds of things that we've heard so many times about John McCain that the press has really stopped asking whether or not they're true. And if you examine each one of them, what you find is that they're either completely false or they've been wildly exaggerated.
And let's go through, let's start with, if we can, the one that I think gets the most coverage, at least among the most coverage, because there are several that win this honor, which would be the notion of his being a maverick.
Well, John McCain votes, over the course of his career, has voted with the Republican Party around 85% of the time, which puts him in about the middle of the pack among Republicans. In 2007, last year, he actually voted with President Bush 95% of the time, more than any other Republican senator. Now, the question is, if that's true, and he's not anything unusual when it comes to the amount of time that he does buck his party, why does he have that image? Well, there's something different that happens when John McCain votes against his party. You know, there's no one in Congress who votes with their party 100% of the time. Every member, occasionally, now and again at least, votes against their party. But if it's a different senator, let's say someone like Susan Collins of Maine, who's a much more moderate Republican than John McCain is, when she votes against the Republican Party, the press doesn't really take notice. Whatever the legislation is that they're talking about, they will still treat it as fundamentally a conflict between Democrats and Republicans, even if there are a couple of defectors. But if John McCain is the one who votes against his party, it transforms the story that the press tells. So instead of telling a story about a conflict between Democrats and Republicans, they now tell a story about John McCain and his courageous rebellion. And he ends up on the front page. He ends up getting on the Sunday shows to talk to Tim Russert or George Stephanopoulos. He's the one around whom the entire story is framed. So even if these cases are few and far between, they take on this kind of elevated importance in the minds of the press and consequently in the minds of the public that makes him seem like much more of a maverick than he actually is.
One of the things, Paul Waldman, that I think the book does quite convincingly is show that because McCain is regarded as a person with really no significant character flaws, the sort of issues that would be dynamite, maybe even career enders or campaign enders for other candidates, simply don't attach to him at all. And he just gets, like you say, a free ride on point after point.
Yeah, and the reason it happens is because the press has over time become almost like McCain's protectors. They will not only rally around him, they will repeat these things, the kind of words and phrases that his campaign wants them to, and when he says something that would get a different politician in trouble, they tend to ignore it or explain it away. And it's happened because, you know, of all the different things that McCain has done well, the one that he's done the best well is to charm the press. And so he invites, one of the things he does is he invites them on board the Straight Talk Express and just talks for hours, doesn't go off the record, and they love that. They don't get that from ordinary politicians, and they're so appreciative that they feel like he's giving them lots of material to use in their stories. And when he does say something that would get a different politician in trouble, their response is, "Oh, well, that's just McCain. We're going to give him a pass on that." And so, for instance, in 2000, on board the Straight Talk Express, he referred to Vietnamese as gooks more than once. If it had been a different politician, even another Vietnam veteran, let's say John Kerry, their response would have been to run to their phones to call their editors and say, "We've got a front-page story here." But with McCain, they didn't say anything. They said, you know, we're not going to report on that. It was barely discussed. It showed up in an article in The Nation, which then caught the attention of some Asian-American groups who started to raise a stink about it, and eventually McCain had to answer for it. But there are lots of cases like that where he says something that for other politicians would be a huge controversy, but for McCain, he gets a pass.
In the book, Paul Waldman, you argue that it's not just the McCain charm offensive with reporters that accounts for the type of treatment he gets from the Washington press corps. There are two other crucial factors, one being the obvious one that's sort of central to the McCain story, which is his experience as a POW in Vietnam, and the second being his support for campaign finance reform. And could you just talk about why those are so important in sort of giving him this exalted position?
Well, in the case of Vietnam, you find it being put into so many stories, literally thousands of times, and often without any kind of relevance to what's actually being discussed. So you'll see stories that will say, John McCain, who was a prisoner of war in Vietnam, today gave a speech on the economy. And you're thinking, what does that have to do with the speech on the economy? But it's become such a part of the way he's identified for reporters that they don't even consider whether or not it's relevant. And we have quotes from reporters, particularly baby boomer men, saying that, you know, because McCain went to Vietnam and he suffered there, that they give him a pass, that they really give him an extraordinary amount of respect and deference because of that, you know, despite the fact that it was 40 years ago, and it's certainly part of his story, but it's not the entirety of his story. There's a lot of things that he's done since then that might bear on some kind of an evaluation of his character. It's something that's hard to overstate how important it is. And what you find with McCain and his staff is they have found that they can talk about it just enough to make sure that it shows up in stories a lot, but not so much that anyone questions whether they're sort of over-exploiting it.
You know, Paul Waldman, that was one of the things that really jumped out in the book. As I was reading the book, I was thinking of Rudolph Giuliani, who, you know, as everyone joked, ran for president as the president of 9/11. I mean, he could barely... his whole campaign is predicated on his being mayor of New York during the 9/11 attacks and how he had risen to that crisis. And it became, you know, a subject of really humor at a certain point because it seemed to be the one thing he constantly was talking about. McCain somehow gets the same effect of Giuliani wanted from 9/11 with his Vietnam War record, but he isn't tinged with one who's always bringing it up, but he does always bring it up.
Yeah, and that's what's one of the things that's really kind of inexplicable, is that you see all the time reporters will say that McCain is so modest, he doesn't like to bring up Vietnam, he does it reluctantly. You see that's the way it's talked about, but the truth is that he brings it up all the time. Now, he has every right to, obviously. It's his story. Nobody disputes the details of what happened to him. But he is quite happy to talk about it when he's being serious, when he's joking, when he's talking to voters, when he's talking to fundraisers. And it is actually the foundation on which his entire political career has been based, going back to his first run for Congress in 1982. You know, his campaign has been running ads showing him as a prisoner of war, but you see, for some reason, these reporters are always repeating that McCain doesn't like to do it, that he's reluctant. Well, he doesn't seem to show much reluctance, but somehow that's part of the story. It fits in with the rest of the story they tell about him, because he's the guy who's not political. He's the one who just has so much integrity and only operates on principle, and somehow the idea that he doesn't like to use his Vietnam War story for political advantage has become part of that story, even though that's not, in fact, the case.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Paul Waldman, co-author with David Brock of the brand new book, Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. The phone number, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Paul Waldman, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The second factor, Paul Waldman, that you and Brock mention in the book is accounting for the tremendous press coverage McCain gets relative to other politicians in Washington, be they Republican or Democrat, is campaign finance reform. Why is that such an important factor?
Well, people may have forgotten about this because, you know, it was a topic that didn't get generate a lot of public interest even when it was going on. But it was a long, lengthy battle in Congress over the course of many years. And what happened with the press was this issue became a vehicle, a way for them to talk about everything they didn't like about politics as it's practiced in Washington today. So they could. It was a way that they could talk about all the backroom deals and the influence peddling and the lobbyists and the influence of money and all these things. And so this became a story that I think the press really felt strongly about, and you could certainly see that in the editorials that were written over the years about it. In this story, McCain became the hero. You know, one of the interesting footnotes to this is that when the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform bill was introduced, it generally was referred to as Feingold-McCain. But somehow along the way that switched and it became McCain-Feingold, and he was portrayed as sort of this lonely Don Quixote character tilting at the windmills of money and influence on this sort of doomed crusade that was so noble, and he alone was going to stand up to the special interests. Well, you know, that wasn't really an accurate portrayal even at the time. But, you know, the bill was ended up being signed into law in 2001 by President Bush. Nobody really thinks it had the effect that it was supposed to. If anything, money has more influence now. There's certainly more money spent on campaigns than there was before McCain-Feingold. But it nonetheless cemented in reporters' minds this idea that John McCain is the guy who takes on the special interests. John McCain is the guy who stands up to the influence of big money. Well, the fact is that that's not really true. If you look at his campaign, what you find is that there are, by some counts, as many as 66 different corporate lobbyists who are working for him. His campaign manager is a corporate lobbyist. His chief political advisor is a corporate lobbyist. His chief fundraiser is a corporate lobbyist. And, you know, just today, I believe, or yesterday, the person who was going to be running his convention operation had to step down because this guy, also a corporate lobbyist, turned out to have lobbied for the military junta in Burma. But that's not too surprising given how many different corporate lobbyists are working for McCain. And there are all kinds of stories that indicate that this image that he has built up of him as the one guy who can't be influenced isn't really true either. I know we could talk about some of those cases, but nonetheless, because of that battle over McCain-Feingold, which took so long, that really cemented that idea in the reporters' minds, and it doesn't seem anything can dislodge it.
And then the third factor we've already alluded to is the self-named Straight Talk Express, McCain's campaign bus, where apparently reporters had the run of the place, could talk with McCain at length, almost as they never do with other politicians. Booze was flowing, and it was sort of almost like a locker room, very masculine environment, where John McCain sort of shared his real man experiences in a sort of and charmed the other reporters by letting them into his club.
Yeah, it really is something unique. I mean, it was one of the most brilliant political moves in terms of press management that any candidate has ever done. You know, we have a quote from Andrew Ferguson, a conservative journalist, who said, I never saw Heifetz play the violin. I never saw Ben Hogan hit a five iron, but I've seen John McCain work a reporter. And on board the Straight Talk Express, it seems like this sort of freewheeling, anything goes atmosphere, but John McCain knows exactly what he's doing. When he gets those reporters on board there and begins to regale them with stories and unleash his charm on them, he has a very nuanced understanding of what it is that reporters don't like about the typical politician. And so he'll do things that will turn those things upside down, but he knows that they're not going to wind up in the story. So, you know, he'll tell a self-deprecating story about himself when he wasn't at his best, when he did something stupid. And the response of the reporters isn't, wow, I'm going to put that in the next story I write. The response of the reporters is, what a great guy. He's not like those other politicians. Now, McCain understands exactly what he's doing when he does this. He has all kinds of little tricks like that that he uses to charm those reporters, and over time they become almost like a little community on the Straight Talk Express, and he is it's almost as though they're part of his team, and so it creates this reservoir of goodwill that he can then draw on when he needs it. And so when he does say something that will get another politician in trouble, they give it a pass. When he does something or says something that might indicate the image that's been created of him isn't quite true, they ignore that new piece of information and continue to say that basically his character is pure, that he never does anything for political reasons, and all those that wonderful image and portrait that they've been painting for so long.
Paul Waldman, I have a good friend who's a working political reporter out of D.C. who has told me forever that McCain is just the most charming guy he's ever dealt with, and really confirmed what's in your book, and I think most reporters say. And when I was talking about the sort of the lumpier press coverage some of the other candidates were getting, his response was, well, why aren't they doing what McCain does? Why aren't they having a bus, and why isn't the candidate Obama or Clinton or any of the Republicans spending time charming reporters like McCain? Why can't others do the same thing?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting question, and every candidate has a slightly different approach to the way they're going to handle the press, and there's this kind of trade-off between getting the reporters on your side on the one hand and having control over your message. The calculation that McCain made a long time ago, and the advisors, he has a team of people that have been working with him for many, many years. I think they decided that if they could get the press on their side and give up a little bit of that control, take some risks in terms of the possibility that he would say something that might get him in trouble, that in fact, in the end, it wasn't really a risk. That when he said those things, they weren't going to call him on it, and he could use that formidable charm of his to really get them on his side. Most candidates can't seem to bring themselves to do that. They're so worried about saying something that will be a problem for them that they can't bear to sort of stray for their talking points. But, you know, it's interesting. There's one other person, one other public figure who seems to have employed the McCain model when it comes to dealing with the press, and that's David Petraeus. If you talk to reporters who have been to Iraq and interviewed him, they'll say they may not say that it's like McCain, but what they describe is exactly the same thing. Petraeus says, come on in, and he just chats with them and is very candid with them, and over time that they really tend to see things his way and see him as a terrific guy. And, you know, if there's anybody whose public image in the press is as universally positive as McCain, it's probably Petraeus. So it shows that it's a very effective model to follow.
You know, I was just listening to a McCain interview on NPR no more than a few weeks ago, and it was a softball interview for the most part. But what was striking is the end of it. McCain, you know, has mentioned how much he listened to the show all the time and how much he enjoyed it, which I suspect took the host, of all things considered, a little bit off guard, because it was not the usual thing you'd hear from a politician. Likewise, I've seen McCain many times on The Daily Show, and his ability to handle Jon Stewart is striking. You refer to that in the book as well.
Yeah, you know, he does actually seem to genuinely like reporters, or at the very least, he's trying to convey that impression. That's something, again, that you don't get from ordinary politicians, and that the reporters respond extraordinarily well to. You know, it's really flattering for them that a politician isn't treating them with the kind of contempt that they're used to, but is really talking to them as though he's interested in them and wants to hang out with them and wants to be their friend. The other thing is that, you know, every politician has his or her strengths and weaknesses. You know, Barack Obama is probably at his best when he's giving a prepared speech. Well, McCain is really at his best in conversation. You know, giving a speech, he can be pretty good, but he's not an extraordinarily talented rhetorician. He's not so great in debates, but in conversation, that's where he really excels, in the kind of back and forth. And since he's so good at that, and he can give you the impression that he's a really interesting and engaging guy, that's the one of the places where he has really won the press's affection. And it's playing to one of their biases, because where does that happen? Well, it happens backstage. There are those interviews, of course, but a lot of the time it's in the back and forth that happens in the back of the bus. That's where they feel like they're forming their more true impressions of a politician, because that's the thing that the public doesn't have access to. So their privileged place as reporters gains them access to that, and they're naturally going to consider that, what they learn there, to be more important than, well, you know, when he gives a speech, what is he saying? And so it's the impressions that they get in those kind of backstage settings that are naturally going to play a more important part in the evaluations that they make of him, and that's where McCain really excels.
Our guest today, Paul Waldman, co-author with David Brock of the new book, Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. Our phone line, 333-9455, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. I can't restrain myself from asking this, but I have a good policy question as well. The first one is kind of scurrilous. A friend of mine lived in Arizona for quite a while, and she was making the case that the Arizona Republic was actually sort of protective of McCain, maybe on personal issues or something. She tells a story that he divorced his first wife like within a month of her having a near-fatal auto accident while she was still recovering, and married this Budweiser heiress, and it just seems like that would get some play. I mean, maybe not in the best circles, but it certainly, I don't know, I was surprised to hear it because I hadn't heard it anywhere else. I don't know if you want to spend much time on that, but the other question is, I want to know how you review the whole issue of torture, particularly because McCain was tortured. The way, you know, he came out championing this story, and then it was undercut by the signing statement, and then when the corollary law that would restrain our special forces or CIA and other intelligence agencies from doing the same, he flip-flopped on it. There's a lot of allegations that it was a quid pro quo with Bush for support or something like that. And I'm wondering how much you review that specifically and then how the press has covered that whole story.
Well, thank you, Colin.
Hang up and listen.
I should add, just before you answer this, Paul Waldman, that you cover both those issues in some detail in the book. So
yeah, we can talk about both things. In terms of the personal life, I mean, you do find that the sorts of questions that most politicians have to deal with at length, McCain hasn't really had to face a lot of questions about. So his first wife, while McCain was a prisoner of war in Vietnam, was in a car accident that injured her very badly. And she was wheelchair-bound as a result. After McCain got back from Vietnam, eventually he divorced her and married Cindy McCain, and he was basically taking up with Cindy while he was still married to his wife. Cindy McCain's wealth and influence pretty much laid the basis for his entire career. You know, lately, people have heard, Cindy has said that she will never release her tax returns. She's worth, by some estimates, as much as $100 million. And it was her influence and her family's influence in Arizona politics that got John McCain his start. You know, the personal issues of personal life, we can debate whether or not they should be discussed by the press and explored by the press. But what I don't think is debatable is the idea that it should be relevant for some people, some candidates, but not for others. And what you find is that there's much more extensive discussion of other candidates' personal life and life histories when it comes to those things than there is about John McCain. You know, this whole tax return question, you might recall in 2004 there was an uproar about whether or not Theresa Heinz Kerry was going to release her tax returns. And you had all kinds of editorial pages demanding that she do so, you know, on the high principle that anyone who's running for president should have to know all of his finances and his spouse's finances. There haven't been those kinds of editorials written about Cindy McCain, and she has absolutely refused to release her tax returns. Now, you know, as I said, she's worth something like $100 million. Wealth and connections have intersected with McCain's personal life in the past, McCain's public life in the past. You know, for instance, McCain was involved in the Keating Five scandal, as people probably remember. Cindy McCain and her father had gone in on an investment on a shopping mall with Charles Keating. And so, you know, you have these cases where it's an intersection between her wealth and connections and his life as a senator. And, you know, they own 8 houses. You know, this is
eight houses?
Something that people would probably be interested in.
8 houses?
They do. I don't know how a couple going to have eight houses, but they have a $4.5 million condo in Phoenix. They have an estate in outside the resort town of Sedona. They have a condo in Virginia. They have three different condominiums on the coast of California. Anyway, by the way, nobody ever asks whether or not this might make John McCain an elitist who's out of touch with regular people. That question always seems to be asked of Democrats. Now, the caller's second question was about torture, and this again is where we see that that the press really focuses on only the things that reflect on McCain in the best possible way. So there was this sort of showdown between McCain and President Bush over whether or not the government was going to be permitted to torture prisoners. And McCain, as the story was written, was standing up for this principle because, of course, he had been tortured in Vietnam, and he had this unique moral authority on it, and President Bush wanted to continue to have the authority to use torture. And eventually they came to an agreement, and the way the story was written was that Bush really blinked, and McCain won, and the good guys ended up on top. But what really ended up happening was that the compromise in the legislation basically gave Bush enough loopholes that he could decide that the Geneva Conventions didn't mean anything and that he could torture all he wanted. And then, just to put to add insult to injury, Bush issued one of his famous signing statements basically declaring that the law didn't mean anything and he could do whatever he wanted. McCain said nothing about this. And there was some criticism of Bush for it, but none of it said, well, where was John McCain when why was he standing by when President Bush basically said that he was going to continue to use torture if he pleased? Then there was an effort by Democrats to have a piece of legislation that would ensure that the CIA adhered to the standards in the Army Field Manual, which basically set some limits on what interrogators can do and whether they can treat people in a degrading and humiliating manner and subject them to torture, basically. McCain voted against that. What we see is that when it comes to torture, there have been limits to his willingness to stand up to the president, even on this issue that the press has told us so many times is so close to his heart, and his intentions are pure and his moral authority is absolute. He certainly had that authority with the press, and he could have made a stink about it when President Bush gave him the back of his hand, but he didn't.
Recently, as he's run for president in the past 2 years, John McCain has made a number of major reversals in previous positions that would seem fairly opportunistic to the untrained eye, yet don't seem to be getting a great deal of attention from the press corps, which still refers to him as the principled maverick of integrity. I'm referring to some extent to the torture issue, but really more to the issue of his relationship to the religious right and the far-right community and his stance on taxation.
Yeah, there have been a number of flip-flops that McCain has done. And, this highlights really the difference between the way that he's treated and the way other politicians are treated. When an ordinary candidate does a 180 on an issue for obvious political reasons, the response of the press is often, well, doesn't this show that he's just a flip-flopper? Doesn't this show that he'll do anything to get elected? Isn't he just a panderer? With McCain, it's as though those questions are already settled. They've already decided that he's the one person who doesn't do that sort of thing. So when he does do it, they either ignore it completely or they find a way to explain it away. Now, McCain has changed his position on immigration. Before the campaign started, he had a comprehensive immigration reform plan, and he had said on a number of occasions that you couldn't just seal the border without having a path to citizenship and a real comprehensive immigration reform. It wasn't going to work. Then, when that began to get him in trouble in the Republican primaries, he turned around and said, okay, forget about comprehensive immigration reform. Now the only thing I'm interested in is securing the border. He even aired ads saying that. But yet, nonetheless, we've even seen reporters say in their articles that McCain took this courageous stand by refusing to pander to his party on immigration, when in fact he was pandering. He has flip-flopped on the Bush tax cuts. He originally said that they were too tilted to the wealthy in 2001, voted against them. Now he says he wants to extend them permanently, and he denies that he ever said that that they were too tilted to the wealthy. He's also flip-flopped on ethanol, which because he was running in the Iowa caucuses in 2008, whereas he didn't run in the Iowa caucuses in 2000, so he became a fan of ethanol. And when it comes to the religious right, people probably remember that he was a big critic of Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, called them agents of intolerance. And then in 2008, when he needed to secure the Republican base, he made up with Falwell, spoke at his university, gave a commencement address there, and started to court other religious right leaders like John Hagee, who people may have heard of, although he hasn't been given one-tenth the attention that Jeremiah Wright has been given. But Hagee is someone, he's the pastor of a megachurch in San Antonio, very, very big in this the what some people call the Christian Zionist movement of evangelical Christians who are strong supporters of Israel and basically want a right-wing policy on everything having to do with Israel. And Hagee also is somebody who has said that Hurricane Katrina was God's judgment on New Orleans because they were going to have a gay pride parade. His views are incredibly extreme. And so John McCain went down to San Antonio, begged for his endorsement, had a press conference where he touted it. And then when McCain is confronted with these things that Hagee has said, McCain's response is, oh, well, you know, of course I don't believe that. That's just nonsense. But the follow-up question, which any reporter should ask but doesn't get asked of John McCain, is, okay, so you don't believe what this guy says, yet you begged for his endorsement, and we're celebrating it, and you've still said that you're proud to have it. So doesn't that mean that your efforts to secure his support are just nothing but cynical politics? If you don't actually agree with the things that he says and his worldview. But that kind of question doesn't get asked of John McCain because the assumption that reporters have had for so long about him is he's the one politician who doesn't do things for cynical political reasons. And so it almost doesn't register when he's obviously doing those things, when he's pandering, when he's flip-flopping. They can't revise the image they already have of him, whereas with other politicians they would say, well, maybe this means that the guy's a pandering flip-flopper. But they don't say that about John McCain.
Paul Waldman, our guest today in Media Matters, co-author with David Brock of the brand-new book, Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. There's a lot of ground to cover. We've only got about 15 or 20 minutes left, Paul Waldman, so let's try to get to cover as much as possible. One of my close friends in Washington, D.C., is very connected politically, says that in Washington it's widely talked about McCain's temper and his tongue and his temperament in general, which is, to put it mildly, hot-headed. And, you know, there's sort of an amazement, my friend says, in Washington that this is not more widely known or understood because it's unusual in Washington to have a person rise to power with quite this sort of explosive temperament and anger issues, to put it mildly. Senator Hothead is one of the chapters in your book. Why isn't this covered in the press?
Well, you know, you have seen some discussion of it here and there. There was actually one article in the Washington Post about it this year. But by and large, even though this is a potentially huge character issue, it hasn't been discussed. And I think that part of the reason is that when the question of John McCain's character comes up, the response of the press is, well, he was a POW in Vietnam. And that's kind of the beginning, middle, and end of the character story of John McCain, as they're going to tell it. But the truth is that McCain has an absolutely volcanic temper. And both Arizona and Washington, D.C. are littered with people who have been insulted and threatened by John McCain. And even some of his colleagues in the Senate, Republicans, Thad Cochran of Mississippi, a Republican, has said that the thought of John McCain as president brings a cold chill to his spine. There are stories of all kinds of confrontations with his fellow senators where he swears at them and threatens them. There's a story in a book that recently came out about him exchanging blows with Rick Renzi, a Republican congressman from Arizona. Even at times his ire is directed at staff people, at ordinary citizens. So we lay out a bunch of these stories in a chapter in our book. But the point is, the question is, why isn't the press talking more about this as a potential character issue? You know, when McCain gets asked about it, he says, well, you know, I'm passionate about political reform, and I'm passionate about, cleaning up earmarks and things like that. But what you find when you actually look at the stories, it's seldom a conflict about some kind of fundamental policy issue. It's when someone stands up to him. And that's when he gets really angry. And so you have all these story after story after story of him being just extraordinarily abusive to people and threatening to destroy their careers and things like that. So, again, if it were a different candidate, I think it would be discussed a lot more. It gets mentioned occasionally in the press, but not nearly as much as it would if it were somebody else.
Much is made of John McCain's expertise in foreign policy and how he's even passed Hillary Clinton's commander-in-chief threshold. He could really do the job. Yet what was striking not too long ago was while in Iraq, he talked about how Iran had been training al-Qaeda. He repeatedly confused Shiite and Sunni. And this was something that I dare say, and I don't think this is even speculation, had any other candidate, Republican or Democrat, done something like that, they would have been, I think, instantly criticized as being completely illiterate on foreign affairs and in no position to be running U.S. foreign policy. Did not have that effect on John McCain at all, did it?
No. And again, it's one of those cases where the press's conclusions about him are already made. So when he comes out and says on three different occasions that Iran is training al-Qaeda, you know, that's sort of the Middle East equivalent of saying that the Yankees are training the Red Sox. I mean, it's not just a matter of confusing some arcane piece of religious doctrine about the difference between Sunnis and Shia. It's about who's on whose side. And as you say, had it been, say, Barack Obama, the press would have instantly said, this raises questions about whether he's really qualified to be commander-in-chief. He doesn't seem to have a handle on who's who in the Middle East. This is our most important foreign policy challenge, and he doesn't seem to know who's on whose side. They would be saying that this was a serious threat. They would be making a big deal out of it and saying it raises those fundamental questions. Because it was McCain, what you found in the commentary among that on that issue afterward was that they would find a dozen different ways to explain it away. They would literally say, well, we know that John McCain has a deep and nuanced understanding of foreign affairs. So maybe he was tired. Maybe he didn't have enough coffee that day. Maybe he was jet-lagged. They found all these kinds of excuses instead of saying, well, you know, does he really know what he's talking about? And I think that when you look at the things that John McCain says publicly about the Middle East, about foreign affairs generally, you find out that they are just as simplistic as what George W. Bush has been offering. You know, for instance, recently he's been saying that that Barack Obama is the candidate of Hamas because some Hamas spokesman said some nice things about Barack Obama. You know, in the afterward, he would say, when questioned about it, well, you know, I'm Hamas's worst nightmare. I think that's what he told Jon Stewart. Again, you know, a press corps that was looking to really explore this question would say, okay, well, if he's looking to basically use the same policies as George W. Bush has, what do we say about the fact that Hamas is many times stronger now than they were 8 years ago, that Hezbollah is many times stronger than they were 8 years ago, and that al-Qaeda is stronger than they were certainly before the war in Iraq? What kind of implications does this have for the policies that John McCain wants to pursue? You know, that's a kind of discussion you could get into, but instead you get commentary that just sort of assumes that John McCain is the one who is strong and has a great kind of well of knowledge and understanding when it comes to foreign affairs generally in the Middle East specifically. But that might not be the conclusion you reach if you actually looked at the things that he says.
Paul Waldman, there was sort of a exhibition match, so to speak, if you could put it that way, between Senator Barack Obama and Senator John McCain 2 years ago in the U.S. Senate regarding some ethics reform legislation. They got some attention, and you write about it in the book, and you write about the way the press covered it. And I'd like you to talk about that, and I'd also like you to tell me if you think this might be some inkling of what we're going to see in the general election in terms of the press coverage of these two men.
Well, it might be. You know, they had a little back and forth. They apparently had a discussion that they were going to join together to work on a piece of political reform legislation. And then Obama changed his mind and decided that he was going to support a Democratic bill that was being released by other Democrats. And John McCain, in a very kind of petulant way, wrote him this letter that was almost, you know, as if it was from one sort of jealous schoolgirl to another about how he thought that he had integrity and now he's learned that he doesn't. And it was really kind of petty and juvenile. But yet when it was discussed in the press, it was like this mano a mano showdown with the old bull putting the young buck in his place. You know, we quote in the book when McCain was interviewed on Hardball with Chris Matthews, Matthews was so effusive that even McCain could barely tolerate it. You know, Matthews was saying, you were the tough guy, you put him down, and McCain kept saying, stop, enough. But that's kind of the way that McCain has talked about, particularly when it comes to any kind of confrontation like that, that he's the manly one, he's the tough one, and also that whenever there's a question of political reform, the assumption on the part of reporters is that John McCain is pure, that nobody else can stand up to him when it comes to reform. He's the one who is the special interest's enemy. And so if there's any kind of an argument between him and somebody else about what the best way to proceed on some political reform question is, the assumption is that McCain must be right, because he, we all know, is the reformer. And, you know, if you actually look at the record, what you find is that he hasn't really done much on reform since McCain-Feingold, and McCain-Feingold itself has been something of a failure.
7 or 8 months ago, John McCain's race for the presidency in the Republican Party was considered to be on very thin ice. He was way down in the polls, way down in money raising. And then he, very in short order, became the nominee. How important was the press in getting him the nomination and the way the press covered him? And how different was the way McCain was covered in the Republican side to, say, that of Mitt Romney or Rudolph Giuliani?
I think that you can make a case that they really pulled him across the finish line. You know, he had this period where he was very low in the polls, was having trouble raising money, had to lay off most of his staff. And in that kind of a situation, what you usually get from the press is what's sometimes referred to as death watch coverage, where the operative question is, when is this guy going to give it up? Isn't this silly that he's still in the race? That wasn't the tone of the coverage of John McCain during that period. There was this almost wistful kind of waiting for him to come back. We know that he's the straight talker. He's the one who, is that maverick. And perhaps he can get back on the Straight Talk Express and revive himself. It was this really sort of encouraging tone to the coverage. And then as we approached the Iowa caucus, the first actual votes, what you saw was this sort of growing chorus of cheerleading about John McCain, that they were saying that McCain might be poised for a comeback here. And just before the Iowa caucus, there were all kinds of predictions about what would constitute victory for John McCain. And most of them said, well, you know, if he can come in third in Iowa and get maybe 15%, that would be a real victory. Now, that you can see is ridiculous on its face to begin with. But what actually happened in Iowa? Well, he came in fourth. He got 13% of the vote, and yet the discussion that night was all about what a great victory this was for John McCain. He immediately got booked on Meet the Press for that Sunday. Remember, not the guy who came in first, Mike Huckabee, not the guy who came in second, Mitt Romney, but the guy who came in fourth. And I know that in the Huckabee camp, they were infuriated by this. They felt that they won the Iowa caucus and should have gotten some credit in the press, but yet all the attention was on John McCain, and it was almost as though they were dragging him into New Hampshire and across that finish line.
We have time, Paul Waldman, for one more caller, so let's go back to the phone lines again. Line 1, Champaign, you're on the air with Paul Waldman.
Okay, you can hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Just a quick comment on the most recent Gwen Ifill program she mentioned, or someone there mentioned that the Republicans are going to try to portray John McCain as a working-class hero, so to speak, and emphasize white working-class votes. And it's been taking a page from what Hillary has been doing to Obama. And apparently McCain, according to a thing on C-SPAN recently, when a father in maybe New Hampshire somewhere made the comment that his factory had closed and his son's job was gone and so forth and so forth, McCain said to the father maybe his son should aim a little higher. Quite a working-class hero, John McCain is. And would you comment on the possible matchup between Obama and McCain, how it may play out? Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, caller. Paul?
Well, I think that in terms of the coverage, it's a little too soon to tell. That's a question I've been pondering for a while. Are things going to change if indeed the Democratic race is over and then we're going to have finally one candidate who will be focusing his attention on McCain, and then the Democratic Party will be focusing its attention on McCain? Are the press going to become a little more critical? Are they going to do more of those investigations, or are they going to continue to repeat those same things over and over, that he's the maverick straight talker, et cetera? I think it's too early to tell because we don't really know yet. I mean, so much of the attention has been on Obama and Clinton that McCain has just kind of been skating by for a little while. I'm hopeful that things will improve, because after all, this is the public has the right to expect that both candidates are going to be judged by basically the same standards. That if we're going to investigate one candidate's personal finances, we're going to investigate the other candidate's personal finances. If we're going to be talking endlessly about the character of one candidate, we should talk endlessly about the character of the other candidate. If we're going to look at them through the lens, a lens that both examines their good points and their bad points, then that should be true of both of them, not just one of them. You know, that's not the way McCain has been covered for the last decade. He has been viewed only through the most noble things that he's ever done, the best qualities that he has. Everything else has been kind of set aside. You know, the press, as always, is going to have an extraordinary influence on how the race proceeds and what the outcome is. If they don't do a better job of treating McCain in the same way that they treat other candidates, it will put Barack Obama at a tremendous disadvantage.
Let's go back to the phone lines, Paul Waldman, because we only have a couple minutes left. We have a caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Paul Waldman.
Yes, I just wanted to say that everything I've heard you say this morning or this afternoon has been that this guy's a bully, and we certainly don't need another bully president. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Paul, let me just take the last couple minutes to ask you one quick question. There was a damning piece on John McCain, or relatively damning, that sort of surprised everyone 2 months ago approximately in the New York Times, going into his relationship with lobbyists and making some sort of hints at possibly impropriety with a female lobbyist. And that sort of story, what happened to that story? Why did it take place, and whatever happened to the charges in it?
Well, it's fascinating how fast that disappeared. Now, there were basically two pieces of the story. The first is the question of whether or not he had had some improper relationship with this lobbyist. What you noticed is that very quickly, almost within hours, the story ceased to be about McCain and became about the New York Times and whether it was appropriate for them to air this story. And I have not seen anybody follow up on that. Now, you can argue that maybe they shouldn't have, that it's not, you know, not a worthy topic of discussion. That's too personal, it's too salacious, it doesn't matter. That's fine. But I suspect that if it were a different candidate, you know, if there were, or even in some cases, a candidate's spouse, if there were legitimate rumors about somebody that Bill Clinton might have been sleeping with, well, you can bet that other news organizations would not have been hesitant in exploring that story themselves and doing follow-up articles. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is what was really at the heart of the story, which is about a company called Paxson Communications that wanted to buy a TV station in Pittsburgh, and they needed approval from the Federal Communications Commission. They and their attorneys gave McCain $20,000. They were flying him around the country on their corporate jet, and at a minimum, their lobbyist, Vicki Eisman, had a very a good friendship with McCain. At the behest of Bud Paxson, the chairman of the company, McCain wrote two letters to the FCC pushing them to come to a decision on this TV station sale. It was almost exactly what got McCain in such trouble in the Keating Five scandal. Almost exactly. And yet, I haven't seen any major news organization that did follow-ups on the Paxson communication story. It butts up against that image of John McCain as he's the one guy who stands up to the special interest. He can't be bought. He's not in bed with the lobbyists. That's what we've been told about McCain, and that's what this story about Paxson Communications really seems to undermine. Yet other news organizations didn't follow it up. It just disappeared completely. And I think that just goes to show, once again, that the rules are just different for John McCain.
Paul Waldman, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters. Paul Waldman, the co-author of the new book, Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. Good luck with your work in the future, sir.
Thank you very much.
And I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, Matt Kessler, who's been engineering the show today. My name's Bob McChesney. I'll be back with you in 167 hours. Have a great week.